of the body. And last year in Orlando, to address the bifurcation of faith and reason and the unleashing of radical secularism. The theme I've been asked to speak on today is rediscovering virtue within the context of the conference's overarching focus on healing the wounded culture and bringing to it Christ's wholeness. Pope Francis, in a famous interview 2 years ago, called the church a field hospital in battle and said that the first thing we need to do is heal the wounds. Sana le ferite, he repeated 3 times. As the title of our conference makes clear, it's not just individual men and women who are wounded in need of healing, but our culture. The church as a whole is called to be a good Samaritan, crossing the road to care for those lesions and seeking in the end of the church to nurse every patient back to health. God's kingdom, as Pope Francis never tires of saying, is one in which, in contrast to the metastasizing, globalized indifference, we recognize we're our brothers and sisters' keepers. Just as Jesus entered into our humanity to heal our deepest wounds, so we're called to continue the Good Samaritan saving mission, paying forward, in today's popular phrase, the healing of so many wounds the divine physician has already bandaged and healed in us. Rediscovering virtue is a broad theme that could be approached in many ways. But within the context of healing our wounded culture by bringing Christ in his fullness, I'd like to approach the topic in a very synthetic way. I'd like to argue that the entire work of the church over the last half century, the work charted by the Second Vatican Council's Pastoral Constitution on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, the 50th anniversary of which we will be celebrating this December. That very Pastoral Constitution that has attempted to be implemented by the popes ever since has been the great ecclesial attempt to help first Catholics and then everyone else throughout the whole world rediscover virtue precisely in order to heal us and through us our wounded culture. All that the church has been doing is precisely to try to help us to uncover that great gift of Christ's virtues that have been buried as a treasure in the field, have us rejoice in them, and then share that gospel with others. Pope Benedict, for example, put his epical theological mind to the service of helping us all rediscover the theological virtues of love, hope, and faith in the 3 encyclicals respectively entitled Deus Caritas Est, God is Love, Spes Salvi, Saved by Hope, and Lumen Fidei, the Light of Faith, which was signed by his successor, Pope Francis, at the end of the Year of Faith Pope Benedict had summoned. The popes of and following the council have likewise sought to help us rediscover what have been called the cardinal or hinge virtues of fortitude, temperance, justice, and prudence, and so many stable dispositions, good moral habits that flow from them. St. John Paul II's famous refrain, non abbiate paura, do not be afraid, from his inaugural homily in 1978, and the way he courageously persevered through the assassination attempt by Mehmet Ali Aga and later through Parkinson's, was an unforgettable commentary on the importance of fortitude today. Pope Francis's work against the cancer of consumerism and John Paul II's life project of the theology of the body toward chastity and continence for the sake of the kingdom have been 2 efforts helping us to rediscover the virtues associated with temperance. Blessed Paul VI, Populorum Progressio, St. John Paul II's whole social magisterium, Laborum Exercens, Solicitudo Rei Sociale, Centesimus Annus, Evangelium Vitae, Pope Benedict's Caritas in Veritate, Pope Francis's Evangelii Gaudium and Laudato Si, have all been dedicated to various aspects of social justice based on what we owe God and we owe others. St. John Paul II's Veritatis Splendor gave us some of the principles of the virtue of prudence. And let's face it, almost every encyclical and exhortation Almost every homily given by a Pope is a prudential application of the light of the gospel to particularly pressing issues. And the whole exercise, not only of the Church's teaching office, but also her shepherding office, is meant to be a manifestation of prudence rediscovered and represented compellingly. The convening of the Second Vatican Council itself to examine the signs of the times by the light of faith and discover, as St. John the 23rd said, ways to repropose the faith to modern man with all his confusion by the various isms he confronts, was a supreme act of prudence. So it's possible and fair to say that the past 50 years in the Church have all been an attempt from various angles to wake the Church up and to wake the world up with regard to the importance of virtue and virtues. That brings us to the question of why rediscovering virtue is so important in this phase of Church history, so that we in the Church might respond to the needs and the wounds of people today. I think that there are two reasons. The first is because the Fathers of the Second Vatican Council recognized a huge need for the renewal of moral theology, for the study of how the human person, made in God's image and likeness, is supposed to live, choose, behave, and love. The Second Vatican Council specifically recognized the need for this renewal to help us go beyond the casuist manual that focused on individual proper decisions and the principles involved, that went beyond obedience to commandments and precepts and the fight against sin, to focus on the acting person. They encouraged theologians to find a more appropriate way to communicate the moral theology of the Church. And when we use that term, moral theology, we know what the word moral means. Theologos means God's word, God's speech. Not only does God speak to us about how we're supposed to act in His image and likeness, but when we're acting in communion with the Lord, He's supposed to be speaking through our body language. And that was lost. Still waiting fully to be rediscovered. But the Catechism of the Catholic Church, published as a result of the Council, and so many seminary faculties across the globe, and novitiates, and lay formation programs, have started to reorder the presentation of the Church's moral teaching so that it focuses far more on virtue than it does merely on the commandments, to focus far more on love rather than the fight against sin. But there was a much deeper reason for the rediscovery of virtue. There was a need for a renewed understanding and presentation of what St. John Paul II would call an adequate anthropology, an understanding of the human person that's fit for who he is vis-a-vis God, a fitting Christian humanism, something that Gaudium et Spes was seeking to catalyze. The ultimate aim of the focus on rediscovering virtue and virtues is not merely the behavior and moral choice of a human being, but what the virtues themselves are supposed to lead to. Virtuous men and women of character, men and women who, to quote the second century great theologian St. Irenaeus, are fully alive. The common aphorism that Blessed Mother Teresa liked to repeat attests. Our thoughts lead to actions. Our actions lead to habits. Those habits lead to character. And character, she said, leads to destiny. Rediscovering virtue is necessary for the human person to rediscover to some degree himself, to make possible his living up to his God-given potential, his experiencing true freedom and self-mastery, and true happiness and self-gift. Rediscovering virtue is meant to help him flourish as the image of God and the image of Christ's own virtues. It's meant to assist him to grow toward full stature as a son or daughter of God. So what I'd like to sketch out in this talk is first the context of why the church thinks it's necessary and urgent to rediscover virtue by looking at our modern situation that is wounded precisely because often we've not been living virtuously. Then I'd like to turn to an overview of some of what the popes have been teaching us over the last 50 years with regard to uncovering this great treasure buried in church naves and the streets of our cities and towns. Third, I'd like to make a brief application of some of what they've taught to the field of healthcare and how the world needs medical professionals to rediscover virtue to strengthen them in the medical arts. And finally, I'd like to finish by integrating this whole theme within the exclamation point that is supposed to celebrate these last 50 years and help us build on their foundation moving forward, which is the upcoming Year of Mercy that'll begin the day after the 50th anniversary of the Gaudium et Spes. So that's where we're going. What is the modern situation that creates so many wounds toward which the rediscovery of virtue is meant to be a response? All of us here would doubtless be able to name certain aspects of it, but I'd like to sketch out some of these deep wounds with the words of recent popes. As we do, I think the need for the rediscovery of virtue will become apparent. And I'd like to talk about five gaping wounds in no particular order. The first is that the human person is living in fear. St. John Paul II wrote in his programmatic encyclical for his 26-year pontificate, Redemptor Hominis, that the man of today seems ever to be under threat from what he produces. That is to say, from the result of the work of his hands, and even more so, from the work of his intellect and the tendencies of his will. All too soon, and often in an unforeseeable way, what this manifold activity of man yields is not only subjected to alienation, in the sense that it's simply taken away from the person who produces it, but rather it turns man against himself, at least in part, through the indirect consequences of its effects returning on himself. It is, or can be, directed against him. This seems, John Paul II underlined, to make up the main chapter of the drama of present-day human existence in its broadest and universal dimension. Man, therefore, lives increasingly in fear. He's afraid of what he produces. Not all of it, of course, or even most of it, but part of it. And precisely that part that contains a special sphere of his genius and initiative, that part can radically turn against him. He's afraid that it will become the means and instrument for an unimaginable self-destruction, compared with which all cataclysms and catastrophes of history known to us seem to fade away. And he continues to tighten the screw. The state of menace for man from what he produces shows itself in various directions and various degrees of intensity. We seem to be increasingly aware of the fact that the exploitation of the earth, the same planet on which we're living, demands rational and honest planning. At the same time, exploitation of the earth, not only for industrial but also for military purposes, and the uncontrolled development of technology outside the framework of a long-range, authentically humanistic plan, often bring with them a threat to man's natural environment, his interior culture, alienating him in his relations with nature and removing him from nature. Man often seems to see no other meaning in his natural environment and which serves for immediate use and consumption. Yet it was the Creator's will that man should communicate with nature as an intelligent, noble master, guardian, and steward, not as a heedless exploiter or destroyer. What's St. John Paul II talking about if it's not already clear? He's describing the fear that we have that splitting an atom and making weapons will be used against us. The tinkering with the human genome will produce a monster who will come back against us. That our knowledge of chemistry and biochemistry and making it weaponized will attack our cities with our own family members, that our technological advancements may end up crowding us out of a job. Even our robots and other scientific tinkering may eventually come back and treat us who made it as an enemy. Human person is suffering a great wound of fear. That brings us to the second context, which is what the popes call the technological paradigm. Pope Francis, in his recent encyclical Laudato Si, wrote, "It can be said that many of today's problems stem from the tendency, at times unconscious, to make the methods and aims of science and technology an epistemological paradigm that shapes the lives of individuals and the workings of society. The effects of imposing this model on reality as a whole, human and social, are seen in the deterioration of the environment. But this is just one sign of a reductionism that affects every aspect of human and social life. We have to accept that technological products are not neutral, for they create a framework that ends up conditioning lifestyles and shaping social possibilities along the lines dictated by the interests of certain powerful groups. Decisions that may seem purely instrumental are in reality decisions about the kind of society we're building and want to build." Pope Francis in Spe Salvi traced this all the way back to Francis Bacon, and he said, "The trajectory that Bacon launched has determined the trajectory of modern times. And it also shapes the present-day crisis of faith that is essentially a crisis of Christian hope, substituting faith in progress for faith in God." And this leads to the third context, an epistemological relativism that leads to a practical relativism we call the wound of secularism. St. John Paul II wrote in Fides et Ratio, his great letter on the combination between faith and reason leading us toward God, "The positive results achieved through the human mind must not obscure the fact," he said, "that reason, in its one-sided concern to investigate human subjectivity, seems to have forgotten that men and women are always called to direct their steps toward a truth that transcends them. Sundered from that truth, individuals are at the mercy of caprice. Their state as a person ends up being judged by pragmatic criteria based essentially on experimental data. The mistaken belief that technology must dominate all, rather than make use of the capacity to know the truth. Modern philosophy has preferred to accentuate the ways in which this capacity is limited and conditioned. This has given rise to different forms of agnosticism and relativism that have led philosophical research to lose its way in the shifting sands of widespread secularism. With a false modesty, people rest content with partial and provisional truths, no longer seeking to ask the radical questions about the meaning and ultimate foundation of human, personal, and social existence." This provided the ground for what Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger said the day before he was elected, the 265th Peter, in his famous talk about the dictatorship of relativism, what it means. He said on that day to the cardinals who would elect him on the morrow, "St. Paul talks about being tossed here and there, carried about by every wind of doctrine. How timely is this description? How many winds of doctrine we've known in recent decades? How many ideological currents, how many ways of thinking? The small boat of the thought of many Christians has often been tossed about by these waves, flung from one extreme to the other, from Marxism to liberalism, even to libertinism, from collectivism to radical individualism, from atheism to a vague religious mysticism, from agnosticism to syncretism and so forth. Whereas relativism, that is, letting oneself be tossed here and there, carried about by every wind of doctrine, is presented by some as the only attitude that can cope with modern times. We, not others, we are building a dictatorship of relativism that doesn't recognize anything as definitive, whose ultimate goal consists solely in one's own ego and desires. And that has consequences in our day-to-day life. Pope Benedict said to the U.S. bishops in January 2012 that there are new powerful cultural currents that are not only directly opposed to the moral teachings of the Judeo-Christian tradition, but increasingly hostile to Christianity as such. He described them, called them an extreme individualism, seeking to promote notions of freedom detached from the moral truth, a radical secularism that finds increasing expression in politics and in culture. What's secularism? He defined it elsewhere as living et si Deus non deretur, as if God were not a given. It's a practical atheism that's become a new de facto religion. When he was in Scotland in 2010, he spoke about it at length, calling attention to this dictatorship of relativism that's threatening our society by obscuring the unchanging truth about our nature, our destiny, our ultimate good. Pope Francis made these concerns his own. I now work for Pope Francis at the United Nations, where we welcomed him just over a week ago. And a lot of the times there is this temptation in the media to try to contrast Pope Francis and Pope Benedict. Pope Francis has made these same thoughts his own. In Laudato Si and in Evangelii Gaudium, Pope Francis noted that the practical relativism typical of our age is even more dangerous than doctrinal relativism. Worse than a theoretical atheism is a practical atheism, in which we say God no longer belongs. When human beings place themselves at the center, they give absolute priority to immediate convenience and everything else becomes relative. This rise of relativism that sees everything as irrelevant unless it serves one's own immediate needs is the same disorder that drives one person to take advantage of another, to treat others as mere objects, imposing forced labor or enslaving them to pay their debts. He goes on to describe a whole litany of modern atrocities that create so many wounds, and he traces it all back to this practical relativism, this secularism, this living as if God didn't exist. Brings us to the fourth malady: the detachment of freedom from its essential and constitutive relationship to truth, and making freedom an absolute. St. John Paul II wrote in his incredible encyclical on the renewal of moral theology 20 years ago, Veritatis Splendor, that the root of so many problems today is detaching human freedom from its essential and constitutive relationship to truth. If we don't believe that there's truth for us to know, if we begin to concede a premise that everything's relative, then our freedom gets unmoored. And when our freedom gets unmoored, we start to use it against others and against ourselves. Certain currents of modern thought, John Paul II said, have gone so far as to exalt freedom to such an extent that it's become absolute. This is the direction taken by doctrines that have lost the sense of the transcendent. When these inescapable claims of truth disappear, yielding their place to a criterion of sincerity, authenticity, and being at peace with oneself, you don't get peace. You get all hell breaking loose. And he would say later on in Veritatis Splendor that there is an urgent need for the Church herself to develop an intense pastoral activity precisely with regard to this fundamental question of the essential bond between truth, the good, and freedom, which has largely been lost by present-day culture. helping man to rediscover it represents nowadays one of the most specific and urgent requirements of the church's mission for the world's salvation. Pilate's question, "What is truth?" reflects the distressing perplexity of a man who often doesn't know who he is, whence he comes, or where he's going. Hence we not infrequently witness the fearful plunging of the human person into situations of gradual self-destruction. And the fifth malady is what Pope Francis calls spiritual worldliness. She speaks about all the time and wrote about powerfully in The Joy of the Gospel. What's spiritual worldliness? He says, it's when we begin to seek not the Lord's glory, but human glory and personal well-being. It's when we place our faith, hope, and love in mammon and the things of this world. And he describes that it takes on many forms, but they can fall into two categories. The first is Gnosticism, where we begin to abstract ourselves from the real world, leading to a purely subjective faith whose only interest is a certain experience or set of ideas or bits of information that are meant to console and enlighten, but which ultimately keep one imprisoned in his or her own thoughts and feelings. This is the main issue at the root of all the gender confusion that we're facing today and how that's leading to a new militancy. It all is based on the reappearance of ancient Gnosticism. In the second tendency, he says, in the same exhortation which he said, all preachers need to talk very clearly and simply. The second, he says, is a self-absorbed Promethean Neo-Pelagianism, which of course I don't need to define. Self-absorbed, we know, Promethean, that we're basically owners of the fire that was given to us by God. We can use it for whatever purpose. And Neo-Pelagianism is basically we barely need God for anything. We might need just a little start from God, but the rest of it is our own efforts, which we leave God as that watchmaker who gave us the watch, but we no longer need him to wind us up. That's the second tendency of this spiritual worldliness, where at a practical level, we believe and behave as if we don't need God. In response to these maladies, the church has been saying that there's a need for a new evangelization. And part of that new evangelization is the renewal of moral theology to the rediscovery of virtue and the rediscovery of an adequate anthropology through forming virtuous men and women, boys and girls. St. John Paul II wrote in Veritatis Splendor, "Evangelization is the most powerful and stirring challenge that the church has been called to face today and from her very beginning." But we need a new evangelization because we've lost the sense of the gospel. So many who even come to church have lost the sense of thoroughly being formed by the gospel in flesh, who is Jesus. He says there's been a loss of an awareness of the originality of the gospel morality as a result of an eclipse of fundamental principles and ethical values. Today's widespread tendencies towards subjectivism, utilitarianism, and relativism appear not merely as pragmatic attitudes or patterns of behavior, but as approaches having a basis in theory and claiming full and cultural social legitimacy. Evangelization, the new proclamation of the gospel, involves the proclamation and presentation of morality. It goes on to say that that was Jesus' first message, right? Repent and believe in the gospel. Both are two sides of the same moral act. And the real goal of all the church is doing is to form saints that open themselves up, which is an act, to God's help, but then respond with faith. It's this life of holiness, which is the life of virtue, that the church has been sent out to heal people, to achieve. part of this new evangelization is this adequate anthropology. St. John Paul II, when he wrote his platform for his papacy back in 1979, quoted what he had worked so hard on in Gaudium et Spes to get into the Magisterium of the Church of the Second Vatican Council. The theological point about Christ that leads to a moral one. The truth is that only in the mystery of the incarnate Word does the mystery of man take on light. For Adam, the first man, was a type of him who was to come. And then man cannot discover who he really is, except in the disinterested gift of himself for others, making his whole life Eucharistic and saying, this is my body, this is my blood, this is all that I have, given out of love for you. Theological point, that we discover who we really are in Christ, and a moral point, that discovery will happen when we start to love as he has loved us first. So St. John Paul II will say there very famously that man can't live without love. He's a being incomprehensible for himself. His life is senseless if love is not revealed. Then he says, we discover this pattern of love, this answer to the human enigma in Christ, in his mystery. And that's why man is the way of the Church. Healing the wounds of the human person is fulfilling what Christ himself came into the world, taking on our wounds to accomplish. That's why the Church needs to be aware of man's situation and respond with all the medicine God has placed at our disposal. Let's turn to the teaching of the Church on the virtues. St. John Paul II wrote in Veritatis Splendor that St. Paul urged us not to conform our mentality to this world, but to be transformed by the renewal of our mind, to have our hearts transformed, our entire person transformed. He said that what's essential is a sort of connaturality between us and the true good, a connaturality rooted in and developing through the virtuous attitudes of the individual himself, prudence and the other cardinal virtues, and even before these, the theological virtues of faith, hope, and charity. This is the meaning of Jesus saying, he who does what is true comes to the light. We're trying to bring about that connaturality between man and the true good, who took on flesh and was born for us of the Blessed Virgin Mary, in whom the rich young man approached and Jesus called out his incarnate goodness. Why are you calling me good? The catechism that John Paul II had written called for a catechesis precisely of the human virtues that cause one to grasp the beauty and attraction of the right dispositions toward goodness. Catechesis of the Christian virtues of faith, hope, and charity, generously inspired by the example of the saints. We all know what virtues are: habitual and firm dispositions to do good. Becomes a second nature, as St. Thomas Aquinas would say. Those are our moral muscles. Let's talk about the three theological virtues and the four cardinal virtues that the popes have been describing. All of the popes since the Second Vatican Council have precisely been trying to strengthen us in faith. And what is faith? It's a trusting of ourselves so much to God that we believe in whatever he says and has done. It's an act of entrustment. It's not just a believing in a content. It's a believing in a content on the base of a trust in the Lord. Pope Francis described this in his letter at the beginning of the Year of Faith, in which he says it's a total entrustment of the human person to the one who reveals. And says that there's a profound unity between the act by which we believe and the content to which we give our assent. And the Year of Faith was not just so that we could learn the catechism better, but so that we, in this occasionally frightening, difficult time in which to live as Catholics, when things are coming against us more and more, that we need to entrust ourselves ever more to Jesus. St. John Paul II described this very beautifully in Veritatis Splendor. that the essence of the Christian faith is not a set of propositions to be accepted with intellectual assent. Rather, faith is a lived knowledge of Christ, a living remembrance of his commandments, a truth to be lived out. It entails an act of a trusting abandonment to Christ, who enables us to live as he lived. It possesses a moral content. It gives rise to a consistent life commitment. It entails and brings to perfection the acceptance and observance of all God's commandments. Faith, when it's real, becomes a confession. We can't help but profess it on our lips. And we can't also help but speak it in our body language like Mary and the saints have done before us. And it does lead us to this type of witness, most of the time white, which we call dry martyrdom, but occasionally it leads to the wet, red martyrdom. The popes have also been trying to renew us in hope. What is hope? Pope Benedict talked about it in his beautiful encyclical, Spes Salvi, in a way that I think is very easy for us to remember. He talked by its negative image first, from which we can see what the real theological virtue is. He says, quoting St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, that so many of the people of ancient Ephesus were without hope because they were without God in the world. And therefore, to live with hope is to live with a consciousness that God is right there at your side. Think about the toughest thing you've had to deal with over the course of this last month. If at that very moment that was happening on the day Jesus rose from the dead and Jesus was appearing to you right then, would it have changed the way you would have reacted? I think for all of us it would. Hope is living with God in the world, unforgetting, as the great desert fathers would say, that God's present right there with us. And when we recognize God's with us, accompanying us, walking beside us, strengthening us, enlivening us, giving us his own virtues, the things don't frighten us anywhere as much. Because we know the Lord is our strength, and he's strengthening us in that moment. Pope Benedict, in that beautiful encyclical, talked about the consequences of this type of hope. Because we recognize that we already have an embryonic possession, heaven, to a small little degree. And we're willing for that possession to let go of all our other possessions, just like we see in the letter to the Hebrews, that they were willing to have all their property confiscated because they had a greater treasure that couldn't be robbed, that the IRS couldn't tax, that moths couldn't destroy. And that's what led them to persevere in faith. Because they really had this notion of where the real treasure was. Pope Benedict was trying to strengthen us all to have that same awareness so that we would have that same courage. The popes have been trying to renew us in charity. What is charity? It's with God's help, loving him with all we've got, and then letting that love totally transform us. St. Thomas Aquinas describes several derivative virtues of it. Beneficence, which is at the top of bioethics, right? Almsgiving, even fraternal correction. That there's a real connection between faith if it's alive and charity. Faith will always overflow into acts of love. We need to keep that as the real litmus test, as the real criterion. For us to live by faith, it's always going to be seen in charity. It's one of the reasons why Pope Francis' example is so compelling for those who are nine toes distant from the church. Because he leads by that image of the embrace of Venizio Riva with his neurofibromatotic tumors all over his head. He leads by the embrace of a Downs boy, whom he grabs and allows to ride in the Popemobile all the way around St. Peter's Square. He leads with charity, and it opens people up to the fact that faith is real. The popes have tried to renew us in courage. Courage doesn't mean we don't have fears, but that we recognize God's going to strengthen us not to let the fears eat us alive and stop us from doing what we ought. St. John Paul II, in his inaugural homily, said to us, don't be afraid to welcome Christ and accept his power. Don't be afraid. Open wide the doors for Christ. Pope Benedict, almost 27 years later, built on it. He said, are we not perhaps all afraid in some way? If we let Christ fully enter into our life, if we open ourselves totally to him, are we not afraid that he might take something away from us? Are we not afraid that we'll give up something significant, something unique, something that makes life so beautiful? Do we not then risk ending up diminished and deprived? And Pope Benedict thundered, no. If we let Christ into our lives, we lose nothing, nothing, absolutely nothing of what makes life free, beautiful, and great. One of the greatest temptations of the evil one is to fill us with this fear. And the popes have collectively been trying to slam the foot of Peter on the head of the devil. It's a particular need for courage with regard to suffering, to the cross, and to death. St. John Paul II wrote about this in Salvifici Dolores, but we're running out of time. About how the Lord wants to strengthen us precisely then to remain faithful because we're united with the one who is our strength. I've been trying to renew us in temperance. St. Thomas lists several derivative virtues of temperance: honesty, abstinence, sobriety, chastity, clemency and meekness, modesty, humility, and studiousness. A real zeal and perseverance. I've been trying to do that all. The theology of the body was to help us to confront the threefold concupiscence: materialism, the lust of the eyes, carnal lust, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, that desire to have dominion over others. And the great way we do that in the share for consecrated life is to learn from our consecrated brothers and sisters what poverty, chastity, and obedience respectively do to counteract these downward pulls. And finally, they've been trying to renew us in justice, that moral virtue that consists in the constant firm will to give God and our neighbor their due. How great a need is there for justice? Every sin is an injustice. We're not giving to God and to others what doesn't. Those are the wounds that are so self-inflicted and inflict so much pain on others. And then there's the whole social magisterium about social justice and how we need to have structures that can actually care for others rather than wound. Let's finish by seeing where this all leads. Pope Francis is invoking a year of mercy beginning this December 8th, which is not only the day when we mark the beginning of our redemption and Mary's Immaculate Conception, but also the 50th anniversary of the closing of the Second Vatican Council and the launching of its implementation and renewal. Pope Francis wants to keep this event very much in mind and alive. Blessed Paul VI closed the Second Vatican Council saying that the old story of the Good Samaritan has been the model of the spirituality of the Council. That spirituality, that work of the Good Samaritan is meant to be rekindled in this ecclesiastical holy year. Pope Francis has said we're all called to be ministers of mercy toward everyone. And if Christ, as he revealed to St. Faustina, is mercy incarnate, then his mystical body must be the continued enfleshment of that mercy in the world. When we think about Christ's mercy, there are five aspects to it. The evangelists tell us with the Greek word explontnese, which means basically he was sick to his stomach. With compassion in the crowds, he did five things. He taught, he fed, he healed, he forgave, and he summoned to pray for harvesters, and then called those very people he had asked to pray to the harvest master as those harvesters. So as we approach this year for mercy, the Lord wants us, having received this fivefold mercy, to pass it on, to teach, and especially form in virtue, to feed, especially those hungry. Pope Francis is always saying, you give them something to eat. And the Lord's nourished us precisely so that we can breastfeed the world. He healed, and how much you become his surgical hands. He forgave and made us rich in mercy so that we could go out and forgive others as he has forgiven us. And he summoned us to pray for harvesters and then has called us to go out and take in that harvest which is white and ripe. The church's mercy, your mercy, and my mercy involves all of these elements. Pope Francis said, mercy is the very foundation of the church's life. All her activity should be caught up in the tenderness she seeks to make present to believers. Nothing in her preaching and in her witness to the world can lack this mercy. And God's going to be showering down graces for us precisely to bring this gift outward. But if we're going to bring this merciful wholeness of Christ to heal the wounds of our culture, it begins by our receiving the Lord's own healing balm. Christ's virtues are the model that we're called to bring outward. It's a model that for the last 50 years the church has been proposing, and despite powerful false prophets and counter-gospels, continues to preach out of season or in. The church is meant to be the inn of the Good Samaritan, the great hospital for all those who are wounded by their own sins, the sins of others, and all the consequences that can trace themselves back to the first sin. Pope Francis' motto was miserando ad quaeligendo, that having received the Lord's mercy, he then likewise received the call to be the minister of mercy toward others. We likewise have received that mercy and that call. May the Lord strengthen us to respond virtuously to this holy summons, to go out to the battlefield with his medicine and heal the wounded, nursing them through formation in the virtues to full Christ-like help and health. Thanks for your attention this morning.